about rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain? What about killing feels? Is there a time? What about all the things that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice all the blood we've shed before? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth, this weeping shore? What we've done. What about all the peace that you pledged your only son? What about flowering fields? Is there a time? What about all the dreams that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice all the children dead from war? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth, this weeping shore?
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 o'clock. Next is Bread and Roses, and tonight we are going to talk with Olanike Olugboji from Kaduna State, Nigeria, about the environmental challenges of Nigeria. Stay tuned.
KBOO is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Native American Youth and Family Center's Micro Enterprise Program, presenting the NAYA Marketplace, where Northwest Native small businesses, vendors, and artisans display beadwork, jewelry, pottery, and more, Saturday, December 7th from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard. Information at nayapdx.org. Vendor information by email at cjw@nayapdx.org.
At the dawn of the day, all the dark and gay. patience with me lost grace. All touched by the radiance that the sun discloses. Oh, hear the people singing bread and roses. Marching, so many women dead. We cry through our city, their ancient call for bread.
Our stomachs are welcome empty. To Bread and Roses. I'm your host, Delphine Crescenzo. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs. That's every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978, therefore making Bread and Roses the longest-running feminist show in the nation. Please check us out on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, you can post comments, and even share show ideas. You can also find us on Facebook under KBOO Bread and Roses. And if you would like to join our collective of women hosts, producers, and engineers, please contact Ani Haynes, KBOO's volunteer manager, at volunteer@kboo.org. Tonight, I have the pleasure to play for you an interview I conducted just a couple of weeks ago with one of the most dedicated environmental activists of Nigeria, Olanike Olugboji. Olanike wants a safe and just environment for all. She founded the Women's Initiative for a Sustainable Environment, also known as WISE, in 2008. The mission of WISE is, quote, to promote constructive environmental ideals, culture, and practices by empowering women, especially grassroots women, to become environmental stewards, end of quote. WISE's approach to the issue of environmental sustainability is an integrated one. WISE engages in environmental projects and programs in the areas of environmental governance and awareness creation, water sanitation and hygiene, municipal waste management, tree planting, women's rights and empowerment, and tourism. Olanike Olugboji, the founder of WISE, has worked for years to mobilize disadvantaged women in Kaduna State, Nigeria, to address a number of environmentally destructive cultural practices in water supply, energy services, urban transport, education, and waste management issues. She is a Voices of Our Future correspondent for World Pulse. You can find out more about her and read her article that she authored about environmental challenges in Nigeria by going to worldpulse.com and searching for Green Girl. Well, I started by asking Olanike to describe the biodiversity of Nigeria. The first thing that I wanted you to do is locate Nigeria for the listeners who might not be really familiar with the geography of Africa. And then, you know, describe a little bit of the biodiversity of your country.
Oh, well, Nigeria is a republic in the West African region with a coast along the Atlantic Ocean on the Gulf of Guinea. The country lies between longitudes 3 degrees and 14 degrees and latitudes 4 degrees and 140 degrees. And we're bordered to the east, west, north, south by the republics of Niger and Chad. That's to the north. And then Benin, Republic of Benin and Cameroon shares the eastern borders right down to the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, which forms the southern limits of the Nigerian territory. That's for our location. And then my country is blessed with a diverse habitat of mangrove swamps, tropical evergreen forest, savanna. We have three, Guinea, Sudan, and Sahel. And then we have quite a number of very beautiful mountain plateaus. We have Jos, Mambila and Obudu, which supports a very rich diversity of exotic and very popular plants and animal species. Our country is also blessed with very significant agricultural, mineral, marine and forest resources. And I'm sure the world knows that Nigeria is one of the main oil and gas producing countries. That's one of our main mineral resources.
And so with such a diversity, what are some of the environmental challenges that Nigeria is facing today?
It's just so unfortunate that a lot of things have gone wrong in terms of what's happening in our environment over the last several decades. So, of the problems I may want to link to urbanization, by this I mean industrialization, rapid population growth, expansion of agriculture, widespread hunting of wildlife for food. Some of these activities of man has resulted in a number of environmental challenges. We have the problem of oil and gas pollution, which is one of the major problems we have in Nigeria. We have industrial pollution. We have drought and desertification. We have deforestation and loss of biodiversity. And then very recently, there's been a lot of flooding, soil and coastal erosion, and then sadly, too, we have a major problem with managing our solid waste.
And we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about some of these, but before we do delve into some of these issues in more details, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you became interested in the environment and how you decided to make it your lifelong mission to raise awareness about environmental issues in Nigeria.
While growing up, I learned from home and also at school on how to be responsible in terms of maybe how to manage waste and stuff like that. I learned that actually from home and school. But I found out that beyond my home and my school environment, there were a lot of things that were not just right in terms of the way people abuse the environment. You could find people throwing things out of vehicle. You find litters everywhere and all that time. I think as a child, I just had concerns about the consequences of such excesses because I also learned from my parents that, such things have human health impacts. And, I think it was just apparent that most people lacked the awareness, interest on how or the capacity to take action, which was one of my own challenges as a child. Of course, there was very little I could do about it. But I grew up with an optimism and that someday I'll be able to take action, and I lived with that. And I saw that my interest and concern about the environment, I saw it as a cause, more of a cause and an opportunity to serve humanity and also contribute towards protecting the environment. Basically, I'll just say that I had a self-awareness which helped me develop attributes which were aligned to my concerns and interests about the environment. In terms of my professional the professional course I eventually pursued at the university level and also postgraduate level. I want to say maybe by fate, I found myself also studying, taking a course in an environment-related field, which is urban and regional planning. So I'll just say that I just grew up with that self-awareness about the environment and that desire to do something about everything that was just not right.
And so with that desire and also with your college education, you've become the executive director and the program coordinator for Women Initiative for Sustainable Environment, also known as WISE. And you've been in that position since 2008. Can you talk about the mission of the organization and how it was founded?
The mission of the Women Initiative for Sustainable Environment is to advance constructive environmental ideals and practices by empowering women, especially those at the grassroots, which I believe, whom I believe are the most disadvantaged. It's about empowering those women at the grassroots to take advantage of opportunities in natural resource access, use, distribution, control, management, and stewardship, because over the years they've been left out of the decision making when it comes to the issues of environment. And as regards the founding of WISE, well, I first and foremost want to talk about my working experience prior to the founding of WISE. I'll say I stepped into the world of social activism in 2004 when, in collaboration with a group of like-minded individuals whom I shared my concerns and interest about the environment with, together but championing that cause, I founded the Environmental Management and Protection Network. It was founded with the desire also to advance constructive environmental ideals. I'll say prior to WISE, I was doing everything, trying to address every issue, general issue that relates to the environment. Mm. But along the line, in the course of my work, I realized that grassroots women are disadvantaged by societal practices that fail to recognize, improve and secure their rights to natural resources. They were completely just left out of everything that had to do with decision-making in relation to the environment. Found out that they were often denied a role in using, distributing, managing, and stewarding our natural resources. And I'll say that this situation makes most of these women the most vulnerable to the impacts of environmental threats. So WISE was a response to that gap that I identified in the course of my work, that grassroots women were left out of taking decision about the environment. And I'll say that basically they are the closest to nature, because everything about their lives, from livelihoods, and day-to-day living, is tied to natural resources.
Yeah, so one of the things that WISE does is try to address some of the water sanitation and hygiene issues. Can you talk about how you do that? What are some of the strategies that you use?
Well, I'll say also one of our areas of interest, which is water sanitation and hygiene, is as a result of the fact that we realize that women are the ones who collect, store, treat, and also use water for families in homes. And most of these women, especially those in the rural areas, they have to walk very long distances to reach the nearest water points. And sadly, most of these water points are not protected, so they're contaminated. But because these women have no choice, they still have to depend on salt water. And in terms of sanitation, it's no different story, because most of these women lack access to safe sanitary facilities, and some of them have to resort to open defecation. And aside from endangering their health, it also has a safety dimension. Because in accessing water, in accessing sanitation, most of these women are exposed to harassment, they're exposed to assaults. There are stories of women who have been raped, maybe while taking such long-distance walks to either relieve themselves or maybe fetch water. So it's a kind of two-way thing, and that's why we focus on the issue of water, sanitation, and hygiene together, because we recognize that women and men's needs in relation to water and sanitation is different. And because it is men that take all the decisions when it comes to water, sanitation, and hygiene, you find out that the interest of women is left out. So our strategies are targeted at addressing those needs and those differences between men and what men need and what women need. And as part of our strategies, we do water, sanitation, and hygiene training. Basically, we our approach is training of trainers. We want to train the women at the grassroots so that they can train their peers, and in that way, we can reach more women. We do a lot of information dissemination, knowledge sharing, in relation to WASH.
Mm-hmm.
We are also involved in strengthening our network by collaborating with women groups and forming, also helping women form new groups. We also build women's capacity in WASH by conducting training of trainers workshop, emphasizes on knowledge, skills, and technology transfer. We do a lot of advocacy also to government, intergovernmental organizations, private organizations seeking for intervention in the area of providing water and sanitation facilities to some of these communities, and very importantly, at very accessible distance to these women. We also raise grassroots women awareness on water sanitation and hygiene, also community awareness on water sanitation and hygiene. We conduct hand washing campaigns in schools and communities.
Mm.
And last but not the least, I'll say that we also provide technical support to women groups,
mm-hmm.
also in the area of WASH, you know, that's water sanitation and hygiene, project planning, implementation, and management.
I'm curious as to what is the government's response to you know, to your outreach to them, and what is your opinion as to you know, very often organizations, you know, nonprofits, NGOs are trying to fill in a gap. Do you think that that should be the responsibility of your government to help with that issue?
Well, I believe that the people are the ones who form the government, and all the time, we cannot expect the government to do everything. We owe it as a responsibility, as responsible citizens, also to contribute our quota. That's not to say I'm ignoring the fact that the government has a responsibility to provide some basic infrastructure to the people. But the government is trying their best, but what I'll say is that it's not reaching, their responses, their interventions are not reaching the people who actually need it.
Hmm.
And that's the people at the grassroots. And I would also want to say that some of these interventions have been so politicized that, you know, it's not really about addressing a problem as much as, you know, some people just lining their pockets with extra cash and all that. And that's why you find out that there are a lot of foreign organizations who are around. There are a lot of local NGOs who are also working. And it looks as if nothing is happening because the real issues are not being addressed. But also the community, what the community needs, they also need to be supported to take action. Everyone needs support to take action, but maybe everyone is looking at the government because the governments are the ones who hold the people's money in custody. So, well, I'll just want to say that everyone needs to rise up and play their part, the government,
mm-hmm.
non-state actors, individuals. Everyone has a role to play.
L'enfant pour 5 francs la semaine vient broder des survettes pour l'homme blanc qui golfe en voiturette, un sale dent sur la planète. Oh, le drôle, drôle de temps. Porter secours, c'est défendu. Le monde autour est sourd, bien entendu.
You're listening to Bread and Roses and to Francis Cabrel, Le Monde est Sourd. I am Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm playing for you an interview I conducted with Olanike Olukboji, the founder of the Women's Initiative for a Sustainable Environment, also known as WISE. She's worked for years to mobilize disadvantaged women in Kaduna State, Nigeria, to address a number of environmentally destructive cultural practices in water supply, energy services, urban transportation, education, and waste management issues. Well, I went on to ask Olanike how she consults with women at the grassroots level to understand the problem that affect their communities. And how has your organization become so aware of the need of the grassroots women? Do you consult with them? Do you, you know, conduct focus group? How do you get to know exactly their needs?
Well, my work is we actually go to the grassroots to meet these women. For example, the World Health Voices of Our Future training, which I'm participating in, we had an assignment, which is our Module 4 assignment. I'd always been concerned about how so connected the lives of a particular ethnic group of ethnic women that belong to a particular ethnic group. I've always been concerned about how their life is so tied to forest resources. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I had to go there, go to the communities. I go to the communities to meet these women. And for some communities, they're fortunate that they have women representatives in the urban areas. For example, also on that project, I had to meet with... For now, I'm in Kaduna. And for that particular project, I had to meet with the leader of the Dagi women. And speaking with her, I was able to also identify with some of the many challenges the women of her ethnic group are facing. So it's all about consulting with the women leaders from those communities and also interacting with some of the women groups. Also, I also want to make reference to the Dagi women. Because in the course of my interacting with them, while studying on the issue of deforestation, I found out the women came to a realization that in actual fact, deforestation is affecting their livelihood. But they never realized it until I explained some of the issues to them. And then afterwards, the women decided that they were going to form a cooperative. So sometimes these women groups are not on ground, but when you get to the community and you interact with them, that results in them maybe forming a group. And for those groups that already exist, we also work with the women group, the leadership of the women groups, because that also helps us to reach out to more women.
And so as you are talking about The Baggy Woman, I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about deforestation and the impact it's having on women in Nigeria and on the women of this particular community.
Well, like I already mentioned, when we're speaking about the environmental challenges we have in Nigeria, one of the main problems is the issue of deforestation. And the forest areas in Nigeria have become largely depleted as a result of illegal logging and overdependence on trees and forest resources for firewood, lumber, and building materials. Our forests are not sustainably managed because, like I was speaking to someone, and I helped the person realize that the truth is that we cannot stop harvesting some of these forest resources, but what matters is making sure that we're able to sustain it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, also in Nigeria, we used to have about 92,000 hectares, that's a quarter of Nigeria's land mass, was once covered by forest. But today, it is estimated that just half of our forest remain, and the potential for their future exploitation is extremely limited because we have not been managing it sustainably. And fir wood still remains the most dominant domestic energy source, particularly in rural communities where dependence is as high as 98%. And speaking on the impact of deforestation on women in Nigeria, I won't say that women are the most vulnerable to the impacts of deforestation because they are the ones who majorly go in search for firewood, for domestic energy, and as a means of livelihood. And like the ethnic group I mentioned, the Baggy women, their livelihood, the livelihood of most of them is tied to sourcing firewood from forests and all that. And with the rates at which our forest areas are diminishing, these women now have to walk longer distances in search of fir wood. More often than not, their daughters, that girls even have to stay away or even drop out of school to help their mothers to go in search of fir wood.
Mm.
And in the process, these women and girls are often exposed to harassment, just like in the case of water and sanitation. They are still exposed to harassment and sexual assaults. And in extreme cases, some are even abducted because they have to go very, very far, far, far into the bush. So sometimes they get abducted. And by spending more time to collect fir wood, these women are becoming poorer and more burdened. And they barely have time to engage in other productive activities. But the truth is that most of these women are ready for change, they're ready for any support that they can get that can maybe help them live better lives in terms of alternative sources of energy, alternative livelihoods and all that. And that's one of the areas that WISE is also looking at, seeing ways by which we can empower these women in the area of alternative livelihoods where they don't have to become overburdened, you know, to make ends meet. So I was just going to emphasize that one of the ethnic groups in Nigeria that is most affected by the issue of deforestation remains the Baggy women.
Mm-hmm.
And they are mostly found, the Baggy ethnic group are mostly found in Niger, Kogi, Kaduna State, Nasarawa State, and the Federal Capital Territory of Nigeria.
And so WISE also has a tree planting program. Can you talk about how that works and how communities can get involved with that program?
Well, we for now, our tree planting program, we started out just in Kaduna State. I'll not say it's such a big project yet, because much of what I've been doing has been more of self-funding. And by self-funding, I mean I raise money by myself. I do environmental consultancy work. And from that, what I'm able to earn, I channel some of it to do implement some of this project. And it's not as if we've not been trying to explore funding opportunities, but sometimes you have very stringent conditions attached to those grants that we may want to explore. Sometimes they expect you to have undertaking projects as high as maybe $100,000, $200,000. And speaking of doing something that is self-funded, you know, we've not gotten to that point, but I'm sure we'll get there someday. But for now, our tree planting project, we encourage majorly the planting of economic trees, because we believe that would also discourage, while people can earn from those economic trees, maybe by harvesting the fruits from those trees, you know, they would not have to cut down those trees for a very, very, very long time. So for our tree planting projects, we encourage the planting of economic trees. And then we also provide, we raise seedlings. We also train women, teach women on how to raise seedlings at home. We also encourage women to have home gardens, to plant trees around their homes. We also do some kind of awareness creation amongst farmers, where we also encourage them to plant trees, because most of the forest areas are what has become farmland today. But what we say, we try to let them know the importance of planting trees and then encourage them to plant trees on their farms, so that it can also be useful for them in terms of what it can do for the environment and what it can do for them on a personal level. So also we try to also participate in tree planting campaigns and any projects that encourages the planting of trees. For example, we have a project with a private company. The director is an environmentalist, and we have a partnership project where we have a tree nursery where we also raise seedlings that we can also distribute to some of the women groups we work with. And also, I want to say that for our tree planting projects, in the course of interacting with the women in the Bagi community, mm-hmm. I was trying to advocate that, because one other problem that women have when it comes to maybe taking active part in tree planting is that they don't have secure tenure to land. That's what one of the issues the women raised. They said they don't own land. Is the men who own land. And, you know, I was trying to also talk to the community head, who said, well, he will look into it, but I'm yet to get back to him to know what's happening. So also, we're trying to also advocate for secure land rights, property rights for women, so that they can also make the most of this land if they're interested in planting trees.
Yeah, it seems that all of it is interconnected somehow, from the violence occurring to women to the issues of deforestation to the issues of land rights. One of the other thing that WISE is working on is so we talked about water sanitation and hygiene, but there's also solid waste management. Would you talk a little bit about that? What are some of the issues around solid waste management, and what you guys try to do about it?
Well, solid waste management is a huge problem. I say a huge problem in terms of both domestic and commercial and industrial waste. You find out that most of the industries dispose their waste in water bodies. For example, recently, a waste from a photo shop somewhere in Lagos, Nigeria, was just dumped in one open place that was close to a school. And there was a kind of air pollution in that area. This was just reported yesterday about, I think, 25 to 35 people passed out, and they're still trying to revive some of these people. Most of them are students. You'll find out that people dump waste indiscriminately, for industrial waste is not treated before it is emptied, released into the environment. Most of the industries don't have waste treatment plants functional. Some have, they are not functional. Then you find out also that at the home level, people are not giving to collecting their waste, their generated waste, properly. Some, at the end of the day, maybe dump their waste into drainages that are provided, and at the end of the day, that also contributes to flooding, because when it rains and there's nowhere for the water to go. And the thing is that some of these things, I think there's a need for value reorientation when it comes to the way we handle and manage our waste. So what we try to do is, we know that sometimes people say that women are the ones who generate the highest percentage of domestic waste, which includes organic components, maybe things you waste from the kitchen waste and all that, because it's women who do the cooking and all that. But what we try to do is we do a lot of environmental solid waste management education. We try to enlighten people. For example, some time back, I produced a radio jingle and also a TV jingle, which I showed at the federal level to the Federal Ministry of Environment and also the state, Kaduna State Ministry of Environment, trying to get them to buy in to the project of creating awareness about the many.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo. I'm playing for you an interview I conducted with Olanike Olugboji, the founder of the Women's Initiative for Sustainable Environment. She's worked for years to mobilize disadvantaged women in Kaduna State, Nigeria, to address a number of environmentally destructive cultural practices in water supply, energy services, urban transport, education, and waste management. I then asked Olanike about petroleum exploitation in Nigeria and the damages of gas flaring on the health of the communities. Another very important issue that I wanted to talk about is gas flares. You talked about how, you know, the main riches of Nigeria is really petroleum and gas. And so I was wondering if you can talk about the issue of gas flares and, you know, the health effect that this has on people and also how it affects women in very different ways.
Well, the issue of gas flaring is one that has lingered in Nigeria. So much has been said about ending gas flaring in Nigeria, but nothing much has changed. And as you may already be aware, oil and gas are considered as the most important mineral resource in Nigeria. And gas flaring results from maybe trying to burn off the gas that comes with the oil in its crude form. And in the process, you find out that a lot of very toxic components are released into the air. because the gas is mixed with heavy metals and toxic water, and the oil must be separated from these other materials. And, well, in the process of burning them off, like I said already, that so much toxic components are released into the air. The worst case scenario as it concerns gas flaring is in the Niger Delta region, where most of this oil is exploited. For example, there are more than 1,000 gas flaring points that release over 23 billion cubic meters of gas per annum. And Nigeria is said to be second on the list of the worst gas flaring countries in the world, only next to Russia. That's according to the World Bank. And, well, talking about the health effects on the people, I've had opportunity, I've witnessed some of the evidences of what, how bad, how terrible gas flaring is and how it affects the health of the people. Gas flaring has led to high incidence of diverse health risks and abnormalities. It goes even as bad as, you know, resulting in deaths in host communities that live next to these flares. And, well, gas flaring is linked to some of the following health problems I would want to list. There are cases of premature deaths, very, very high cases of respiratory illnesses, because, of course, this has to do with air pollution. So the people are exposed to a lot of respiratory illnesses. You have coughing fits. You have asthma attacks. You have issues of headaches, dizziness, irritation of the eyes and nose, nausea, you know. And, well, these people have nowhere else to go. So they've lived with it. They have continued to struggle for change and all that, but nothing much has changed. And it's really very, very sad that women also still remain the most vulnerable to the impact of gas flare. Because in carrying out their traditional responsibilities or roles of homekeeping, cleaning, fetching water, going to the farm and what have you, you find them that in such instances they are exposed to most of these noxious components from the flares. And for women, there are certain health implications that is peculiar to women. You have issues of miscarriages. You have terminal illnesses like cancer. I want to quote the leader of the HOSTCOM. By HOSTCOM, I mean Host Oil and Gas Communities in Nigeria, the women's wing, their leader, Karina Gasidi, sometime early this year, was talking about the effects of gas flaring on the lives of women in Niger Delta. She specifically mentioned the issue of cancer, that they are being exposed to a lot of cancer. I'm sure they have their statistics. And then there are cases of birth defects, depression amongst these women, because they have no alternatives. They must get water for their families and all that. You have cases where women fetch water and then, you know, there are black particles and, you know, sometimes all they just have to do, they have no technical knowledge of the pollution level of this water. And they just must get water for their family. So sometimes they can't even treat this water. They only wait for it to settle and, you know, you have both short-term and long-term health hazards that women are exposed to because of the flaring. And, well, the laws that will protect the health of women, their families and communities is still left in the dark, because all we do is hear every time that, okay, gas flaring is going to end, gas flaring is going to end, from the policymakers, from those in government and all that. But the people are still left to their fate, and they're still crying out and struggling, you know, to see that at the end to gas flaring truly happens.
I'm wondering if, you know, you are afraid for your safety and security as you're speaking out about these issues.
I have my concerns, but really, someone just must, I don't know, something just has to change, because this has nothing to do with discrediting anyone. It's about, you know, asking us to do what is right for ourselves, for the people, for the citizens, and for also our ecosystem. We all stand to benefit.
Yeah. Well, you know, you are a wonderful example of what a woman leader can do. And I'm wondering if you can talk about why, in your opinion, is women leadership so essential when it comes to environmental issues?
Well, from all we've discussed so far, I'm sure that to an extent, we would have been able to appreciate that, in actual fact, that women are actually the most vulnerable to the impacts of environmental problems. In fact, environmental problems has the highest and harshest effects on the lives of women. And that is the very reason why women cannot just sit back. There's a strong connection between empowering women and sustaining the environment, because we've gone over and over talking about how women are so dependent on the environment and how the problems of the environment also affect the lives of women. So the connection is very, very strong. And then women need to be able to make choices, because they are the ones that are worst impacted by environmental problems. And if those women are not empowered, if they don't have rights to maybe decision-making and as such, you find out that the problem, the circle of the problem will remain. And I'll say that it is, of course, an established fact that communities fare better during natural disasters, when women play leadership role in early warning systems and reconstruction. Women care a lot about their family. They care about themselves. They care about their children. They care about, you know, people around them and all that. And they are always ready to give whatever it takes to make sure that their family is comfortable, whatever threatens their family survival, whenever family survival is at stake. The women are ready to go all out, make necessary adjustments as it will impact positively on their families and their community. Hence, they need to ensure that their voices are represented and they are also actively involved in taking and making decisions about environmental issues. You know, nobody will do it for women. So women just need to rise up and, you know, take on leadership. It's very important because, like I mentioned the other time, that the needs and interests of men who are at the forefront of decision-making in the environmental sector is different from what women need. So women need to be given an opportunity to voice their needs and their interests and their concerns. You know, in that way, I believe we have... more harmonious, friendly, and representative policies, you know, not something that will just be one-sided. Because when you get people who are stakeholders, when you get them involved in the process of change, you know, it becomes more meaningful, it becomes more impactful.
You know, we talk about all throughout this conversation about the environmental issues that, you know, Nigeria is facing as a result of, you know, things impacting, you know, its communities, you know, the deforestation, the solid waste, etc. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about climate change as far as, you know, how the warming of the planet globally and what maybe pollution and other issues is happening outside of Nigeria is actually impacting also communities in Nigeria. I know you mentioned floods recently. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, when it comes to the issue of climate change, I know there's still a lot of controversies that still surround it and still challenge the reality of climate change.
Yeah.
But in actual fact, its effect is alarmingly being experienced in Nigeria. Climate change is here with us, and we can see it. The weather patterns have become very unpredictable. And problems associated with climate change in Nigeria include rising atmospheric temperature. For example, there are parts of Nigeria that were known to be the hot zones when it comes in terms of temperature. But there are a lot of other parts of Nigeria where you have very, very unbearing temperatures are becoming very unbearable, you know, what people are not used to. We have increased rates of droughts and desertification.
Mm-hmm.
We have flooding and erosion, which has become very, very, very challenging in Nigeria. And we're still struggling with how to manage the flooding crisis that we have. For example, last year, Nigeria, in fact, I'll say more than about one-third of Nigeria, of states in Nigeria, experienced flooding last year.
Mm-hmm.
And because of some of the problems associated with climate change, you have high rates of migration and conflict because people are moving from unfavorable areas, especially when you talk about the hinterland. You know, there's really a lot of struggle for resources. You have conflicts and all that. For example, when it comes to the issue of grazing, you find out that most of the nomads, you know, they are having to move from areas that are now have now become drought and desert prone. You know, they are moving to greener areas.
You're listening to Bread and Roses. I am Delphine Crescenzo. And I've been playing an interview that I conducted with Olanike Olugboji, an environmental activist from Nigeria. She is the founder of WISE, the Women's Initiative for a Sustainable Environment. You can visit wisenigeria.org to learn more about the work of the organization and what you can do to help. Olanike is a Voices of Our Future correspondent for World Pulse, so you can also find more about her and read her article by going to waltpulse.com and searching for Green Girl. Thank you for tuning in to Bread and Roses. We are a collective of women identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday. Check us out on the web, kboo.fm, and on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. Next week, the amazing Leanne Kranz will be your host. Have a great week, everyone, and I will leave you with the Digging Roots.
Revolution, I saw. KBOO Portland. It is 7 o'clock right now, and we are ending Bread and Roses and about to go into Hard Knock Radio. So stay tuned.
KBOO's underwriting coordinator. Every day, local businesses support KBOO through program sponsorship or underwriting. These underwriters are people like you, progressive, diverse, and supporting real radio. So when you hear an underwriter's acknowledgement, consider giving them some of your business and telling them that you heard about them on KBOO. If your business would like to reach out to the area's 55,000 most diverse and progressive listeners, you can learn how at kboo.fm/underwriting, by email to underwriting@kboo.org, or call Justin 503-231-8032. KBOO Underwriting. Your clients are listening.
What's up, fam, and welcome to Hard Knock Radio. As promised, we continue with part two of Enemies of the State, Government Surveillance in Our Communities. I'm Anita Johnson. All this and more ahead, so keep it locked.
What we got to say, fight the power. What we got to say.
And again, you're tuned to Hard Knock Radio. Right now, what we're going to do is jump back into the talk, Enemies of the State, Government Surveillance in Our Communities. Again, this panel was moderated by Professor Jared Ball of Morgan State University and features Duruba Bin Wahad, leader of the Black Panther Party, Adwa Masosi of Bill of Rights Defense Committee, Fahd Ahmed, This Is Rising Up and Moving, Sister Seema of the ACLU DC, and Alfredo Lopez representing May First People Link. Also, this conversation, this panel discussion, was hosted by Voices for Internet Freedom, a project